This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. At the dawn of the 20th century, Chicago's Everly Club stood in the 2100 block of South Dearborn on the city's near south side. The phone number, Calumet 412. The address and the number were known to royalty, politicians, actors, athletes, and writers. The Everly was Chicago's most celebrated bordello. On the program today, the story of the rise and fall of the Everly Club. Our guest is journalist Karen Abbott. She is the author of Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. Sisters Ada and Minna Everly were the madams of the Everly Club. Unlike other brothel owners, they paid their prostitutes, handsomely, and they fed them well. The women of the Everly dined on gourmet food and wore couture gowns. Ada carefully interviewed each young woman for employment. Then Minna tutored them in the arts of the courtesan. There were lessons in poetry. Minna called her girls butterflies. As for the clients, a letter of referral was required. All transactions were handled discreetly by check. Anyone who spent less than $50 was to be banished. Eventually, scandal and calls for reform brought an end to the Everly and other houses of prostitution. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Karen Abbott, is a journalist, formerly on the staff at Philadelphia Magazine and Philadelphia Weekly. She's also written for Salon.com. Sin in the Second City is her first book, and it has just made the New York Times bestseller list. The publisher, Random House. You can find out more about the book and our guest at the website www.sininthesecondcity.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Karen Abbott, welcome.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Congratulations.
Thank you.
One of the fascinating aspects of this story is the theme of identity. And in your author's note, you say the Everly sisters had been girls who disappeared, and when they reappeared, they had reconstructed their histories at a time when America was updating its own. When you began the research for this book, Sin in the Second City, did you realize the story would be in large part about identity, both personal and collective?
No, not at all. When I began researching the Everly sisters, I just was sort of enchanted and enthralled by these two fascinating, cunning women who were really brilliant entrepreneurs and one of our, you know, two of our earliest female entrepreneurs. And it was only sort of after I began examining the political changes that were happening at the time that I realized this was also a story about America's identity crisis and also, you know, the story of thousands of women. It wasn't just about two women, but the thousands of women and what their lives were like around the turn of the last century.
Yeah. Now, the business of reconstructing these shifting histories and identities, did that prove a challenge for you in your research?
It was. They were such cunning liars. They presented themselves as these two aristocratic women, these women of social standing and grace. And these personas were just as important to them as the decor of their parlors and the beauty of their girls. I got a lucky break when I spoke with their great niece, who sort of helped me dismantle a lot of their myths and reconstruct a lot of what really happened to them. And it turned out they had very tragic upbringings. And I think that's a lot really informed the way that they treated their girls.
Mm. What is known about them?
It is known, you know, they were truthful about one thing. They did come from an aristocratic family in the South. They came from a family in Virginia that had, you know, one of the earliest settlers of Fredericksburg was one of their ancestors, doctors, lawyers, surgeons, senators, congressmen, even a descendant of Andrew Jackson. But the family had a large plantation. It was decimated by the Civil War, and they lost all of their money. And the great niece, the most shocking revelation she told me was that their father is the one who had forced them into the business of prostitution to help make money for the family.
Hmm. Now, how did they get from the South to Omaha, Nebraska?
Well, they went to, the family went to Missouri, which is where I'm guessing they began in the sporting life, as it was called back then. And they were very smart. They sort of knew how to capitalize on opportunities. And at the time, you know, every town tried to boom itself by holding expositions and fairs, the most notable one, of course, being in Chicago in 1893. But in 1898, Omaha, Nebraska was holding the Trans-Mississippi Exposition, and the sisters figured, oh, well, if we can get somebody to back our enterprise, we can take advantage of all the wealthy cattle and tradesmen that will be passing through the town. And they did exactly that.
Yeah. Now, before they got to Chicago, they kind of did a tour.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a wacky tour.
It's amazing. One of the interesting things that I was fascinated to write about was the way that, you know, when you think of prostitutes today, you think of this lone streetwalker, you know, this maybe drug-addled woman toiling under the menacing gaze of her pimp by herself. And, you know, back then, prostitution was this visible, viable business. It was sort of like the auto industry. It was in every city with a population of 100,000 or more, there was this huge network where all madams knew each other and referred each other, and if they liked each other, would help each other out. So when the Everlys went on this tour, they hooked up with all of these madams on this network to try to get some advice as to where to set up shop, and it turns out Chicago was the ideal place.
Yeah. Now, how did they come to their view of how to run a house of prostitution, come to their philosophy, if I might use that word, of how things were to be done, how they would do it?
I think philosophy is an accurate word. They were very careful about, they knew exactly, in the book I call them a 19th century amalgamation of Martha Stewart and Madonna. And it's true, they were incredible perfectionists and knew exactly what they wanted to do. And I think that because they came from tragic circumstances and they knew that what their family had lost, they knew their family had lost its grandeur, and their main goal was to recapture that grandeur for themselves and also in the process treat young women who work for them as they would have wished they were treated when they began the business. So, you know, they went about making things as beautiful as possible. They had the jets that shot perfume into the air and a $15,000 gold piano and, $650 gold spittoons and $50 entrance fees in an era when, you know, 50 cents would get you a three-course meal.
Yeah, and the club stood at 2131 to 2133 South Dearborn. Can you give us some idea of the size and space of it?
Sure. It was a double mansion, and it was 50 rooms, and they had each, in the book I actually have pictures of both entranceways. Both 2131 and 2133 were very lavishly appointed with ferns and statues and expensive oil paintings and these thick oriental rugs and mirrors, and it was, and, you know, tin, these intricate tin ceilings. And you would walk in and each parlor was done in a different color. They had a red room, a blue room, a green room, a gold room, a silver room, and even sort of ethnically themed rooms like a Moorish music room, an Oriental music room. They had a dining area that was called the Pullman Palace, and it was done all in mahogany and designed to look like a Pullman Palace car, which, of course, was the height of luxury at the time.
Mm. When did they open?
February 1st, 1900.
Yeah. And that opening night, what were the standards for entry on opening night?
Well, it was, they did not, unlike other madams, they didn't believe in sort of littering the levee streets with crass cards about their opening. They just thought, if we open quietly, people will come. If we make it hard to get in, more people will want to come in. They sort of pioneered that idea of exclusivity as something that can actually help your business. The first night they turned a few people away who didn't meet their standards, and then they lucked out and had a bunch of cattlemen from Texas come in and spend a good bit of money. And they also had well wishes from madams across the country, and a few important levee district leaders stopped by, and they did quite well for a Thursday night, as they said.
Yeah. Now, what about the competition in the neighborhood, in the levee? Who were their competitors?
Well, there was a main competitor. Her name, I write about her quite a lot. She's one of my favorite characters. Her name's Madam Vic Shaw, and she was the queen of the levee before the Everlys came. And she, you know, was sort of a struggling madam who tried to be as grandiose as she could be and tried to be opulent like the sisters. But you know, the sisters were truly uptown, and Vickshaw really didn't know what uptown looked like. It was sort of a hard mirror for her to look into when she realized that she was quite clearly inferior to the Everly sisters. And, you know, the Everly sisters would drive down, I love this story, they would drive down Dearborn Street in their handsome carriage with their two finely dressed horses with tassels hanging, and Vickshaw would become enraged by the sight of this, and so she'd go out and get four horses and drape her horses with 20 tassels and get a bigger coachman and then drive in front of the Everly Club and toot the horn until they saw her. And it was a very sort of quid pro quo thing between them. And the worst thing, though, that Vickshaw tried to do was to frame the Everly sisters for murder twice. So that was quite an extreme thing to do, but Vickshaw would stop at nothing to ruin the Everly sisters.
Yeah, and Vickshaw, the rumors that she started about Marshall Field Jr.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This was one of the scandals.
Yes, he was shot in 1905, and the Field family, of course, was putting forth their official version, which was that Marshall Field was shot while cleaning his gun in preparation for a hunting trip. But the juiciest and most persistent piece of gossip was that Field was shot while cavorting at the Everly Club, and these Scarlet Sisters, Minna and Ada, were able to whisk his body out in the dark of night and plant him back in the Prairie Avenue mansion. And Vickshaw, you know, saw this as an opportunity to get Minna and Ada and try to hire somebody in the Levy District to frame Minna for the shooting.
Yeah. And the other scandal, what was that?
That happened a few years later. The other thing Vickshaw would do is anytime the Everly sisters got rid of a girl, and they had very strict rules for their girls as well as their clients. Mm. Their girls were not to indulge in excessive drinking or drugs or deal with morphine salesmen or anything like that. They had very high standards for their girls. If the Everly sisters ever fired somebody for breaking these rules, Vickshaw would welcome the harlot with open arms and take all these Everly Club cast-offs. And Vickshaw, a few years after the Marshall Field Jr. incident, decided to try to frame Minna again. A millionaire's body was found in one of her rooms, and she had this crazy notion that she was going to plant it in the Everly Club furnace. But the plan was thwarted by an Everly Club girl who still felt loyal to Minna and Ada, even though she was now at Vickshaw's place.
Mm, down and dirty.
Yeah.
In the early part of the book, one of the things that we kind of see up front coming toward us is when you say the sisters had decided long ago to permit no stains, blood or otherwise, on their house. Discretion paid, but also had its price. How did the sisters maintain discipline in this business? What did discretion cost?
Well, they were in very good with the Levy District leaders. They paid protection payments like everybody else, but they all expected their protection payments to be honored since they were paying the highest. If the sisters crossed any of those Levy District leaders, they would, you know, risk ruining their house. This was evident. This was evidenced once in 1909. There's an incident in the book where Jack Johnson, the famous black heavyweight champion, who just was, you know, the first black heavyweight champion of the world, tries to get into the club. And while the sisters took pains to insist that they weren't personally prejudiced, they also knew that their wealthy white clientele would not appreciate mixing with other races in the parlors. So, but Jack Johnson brought with him a Levy District leader named George Little, who also happened to be his manager. And the fact that he brought this man made certain that Minna would have to admit him. So it was just sort of this delicate balancing act they did between their own rules and the Levy District rules, and which should trump the other at which circumstances and which times.
Yeah. Now, the Levy District is in the city's first ward, and it's still somewhat infamous today.
Yeah.
Pretty tough area politically. They discovered pretty quickly who the movers and shakers in the city's first ward were at this time, and they were a couple of aldermen, Hanky Dink Kenna and Bathhouse John Coughlin. Tell us about these two folks.
Well, it's funny. I talk with Rick Kogan of the Chicago Tribune, and he always is fond of saying, you know, these two, Bathhouse John and Hanky Dink, the lords of the levy, would scoff at any Chicago politic scandals going on today. These two are sort of the pioneers of the Democratic political machine, and you know, the masters of Chicago politics. And, you know, Bathhouse John was this huge 300-pound man. He was sort of bumbling and daft and very gregarious and wrote these really awful ballads that posed questions like, you know, why did they build Lake Michigan so wide? And his sidekick was Hinky Dink, who was this pretty much exact opposite. He was this diminutive little man who didn't like to talk and was really brilliant politically. That he is the one who set the price for votes and recruited people to the Democratic Party by giving, you know, homeless people free beer and really kept the machine running smoothly.
Mm. Karen Abbott is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener, someone calling in this afternoon from Danville, line 4. Hi.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi.
Very interesting show. Thanks for taking my call. Quick question, I'll ring off. I have a book called Yesterday Chicago, and they actually have pictures of the Levy sisters in there, and I was really taken aback by how attractive they were, given their profession. I think you have an idea of what people would look like, but they look very attractive. Anyway, was wondering if your guest in her research came across a reformer, I believe her name is Lucy Parsons Gaston, of the time, and the story is that she actually met the Levy sisters, and she said to them that they were going to go to hell because they allowed their girls to smoke cigarettes. And I was kind of taken aback by that, and I was wondering if your guest came across any research on that. And I'll go ahead and ring off. Thank you.
Okay.
Actually, it's a great question. I do write about Lucy Page Gaston. She was the head of the Anti-Cigarette League and actually one of the sisters' favorite reformers because they thought she was hilarious. You know, she was obsessed with smoking. She didn't care about the prostitution so much. She just didn't want the girls to smoke. So she would often, there's stories about her knocking on the club's doors and coming in and saying, Minna, Minna, your girls are going to hell. And, you know, Minna knew what the answer was. And, of course, the answer was get them to stop smoking cigarettes. So, she was quite a character, and I do write about her.
Yeah, and there was also an anti-saloon league.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a number of different kinds of reform movements percolating.
Right, right.
At this time. Well, tell us, describe what the Everly sisters look like, Ada and Minna, and what their personalities were like.
Well, he's right, they were quite attractive. And, you know, I think their advice to their girls was, one $50 client is better than five $10 ones, less wear and tear. So they were very, they emphasized the importance of physical upkeep. They also made their girls drink, tomato juice and eat their vegetables. And I'm sure they took care of themselves in the same way. And Minna was the outgoing, boisterous sister who would mingle in the parlors. I think she was a master social manipulator and could sort of control a room better than anybody. And Ada was the one who was quieter and kept the books and was really the brains behind the operation.
What was the city like at the time Ada and Minna opened up?
Well, Chicago at the turn of the century was this, you know, bustling, sophisticated city as it is today, but it was also very dangerous. There were guidebooks, you know, warning people about which streets to avoid and what establishments to watch out for. And, you know, they had these lurid titles like Chicago and its cesspools of infamy. You know, and the white slavery scare, the whole idea that young mm-hmm. women were being drugged and raped and forced into brothels, originated in Chicago and spread across the country. But Chicago was really, you know, a microcosm of America at the time and really changed American history at that time.
Yeah. What was life like day and night for the butterflies of the Everly Club?
Well, they, as far as, especially, I mean, look at it this way. If you were a girl in Chicago, you're lucky to get a job as a clerk for $6 a week. At a lesser whorehouse, you might get a job for $15 a week. And at the Everly Club, you can make anywhere from $100 to $400 a week. So these girls were living quite well. They wore good couture gowns. They ate gourmet food. They slept in, you know, marble inlaid brass beds. And, you know, the Everly sisters really tried to treat them like investments. They even tutored them in the poetry of Longfellow and made sure they were able to discuss politics of the day. As one Everly Club client was famous for saying to Minna, well, you know, isn't that educating the wrong end of a whore? But the Everly sisters really thought that it was important to treat the girls as investments. So
yeah. Now, how did the lives of the girls in the Everly Club differ from the situation for the prostitutes who were in the dregs of this way of life?
Well, in the lesser houses, you know, the girls were treated as disposable commodities. You know, they would, a madam would keep most of her earnings. She would keep a doctor on staff who was a charlatan, you know, and forge the reports. And these girls, even if they were sick or diseased, they'd still be forced to go to work. A lot of them kept a whipper on staff, Vickshall included, to sort of, you know, discipline the girls if they got out of line. Vickshall's whipper happened to be a woman named Lil Kowalski, and there's a picture of her in one of the archives in Chicago, and with a caption underneath saying she beat up over 1,000 harlots. It was sort of a point of pride for a madam to have a good whipper on staff if you were in a low house.
Hmm. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, in terms of the area that she was in, if you compare that with you know, the near north and Chicago, a lot of wealth, mansions, and all that kind of stuff. What did that particular area look like, or what kind of, and also in terms of drawing, how far did she draw into, you know, from people from where, you know, where, that kind of thing?
Okay.
Was he asking about the parameters of the levee district, or?
Yeah, and what did things look like there on the street, right?
Yeah, but in terms of the wealth, in other words, okay. I know Chicago. I taught in Chicago, and you take the near north and through a lot of mansions. There was certainly a lot of wealth. Actually, the west side of Chicago is certainly deteriorated, but one time was a lot of wealth there. So in that district, at that, you know, today it's not, you know, when you get in the 2000 block, it's okay, but it must have been quite a different area at the time. Was that sort of close to the center of Chicago at that point, or not?
Well, it's a near south side, and the first word was interesting because it encompassed, you know, businesses, some of Chicago's cultural institutions, some fine shopping and fine dining, all of these upscale establishments, and then it also contained the levee district, which was just block upon block of dive and saloon and brothels and whorehouses and cribs, as they called them. And the levee district was from 18th to 22nd Clark to Wabash, roughly. And, you know, it was a dangerous place to be. I mean, the Everly Club was sort of the shining symbol there, but a lot of the places you would not want to be wandering through the alleys at night. It was a scary place.
There was also, and I don't know, I thought it was on the south side, too, in terms of jazz. There were a lot of jazz clubs and stuff, but was that late? Maybe that was in the 20s.
Yeah, I think there was still ragtime. You know, Scott Joplin, actually, and a few of his contemporaries, played, toured around brothels, including the Everly Club. They did brothel gigs. So that, I thought that was an interesting piece of information and put that in the book.
Okay, very interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, tell us about some of the other entertainments of the Everly Club in terms of musicians. I mean, wouldn't they have an orchestra from time to time?
They had a three-stringed orchestra on staff.
That's right.
Yeah, and they had Scott Joplin did play there. Also a house professor, they called them. They called the piano players professors. His name was Vanderpool Vanderpool. You know, so there was always musical entertainment going on, and you know, Min and Ada really are the, you know, pioneers of making entertainment for their guests. I mean, there's a story in the book about Prince Henry of Prussia, and they didn't want to just, you know, let the prince come to the brothel and sort of enjoy the girls. They put on a whole Greek mythological reenactment of the killing of Dionysus' son to entertain the prince with. So
yeah, and would it be fair to say that the sex was like secondary almost?
In a way, I think so. It was a gentleman's club, and you know, men. You know, the whole mythology of the place, and, you know, the sisters capitalized on this. Apparently, some of their clients said, I'm going to get Everly tonight, which was shortened to, you know, the more graphic term that's used today. And the sisters, you know, capitalized on these myths and were able to sort of create an aura about the place that people just wanted to be seen there. It enhanced your reputation to be a member there.
Yeah. Besides the Prince of Prussia, who else was among the clientele?
Oh, Prince Henry of Prussia, Theodore Dreiser, Edgar Lee Masters, the poet. I mentioned Jack Johnson, mm-hmm. John Barrymore, the actor, and also some quirky characters who didn't have a big name but sort of made a name for themselves by their requests. One of my favorites is a guy by the name of Uncle Ned, who, you know, once a year around Christmas time would come in And he didn't want to go upstairs with any of the girls or eat at the Pullman Palace car. He just wanted to put his bare feet into two buckets of ice and have the girls dance around him while singing Jingle Bells. So they catered to all kinds.
Wild. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Karen Abbott. She is the author of Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Well, how did folks get in and out of this club? I mean, we've got all kinds of, people of some reputation, royalty, politicians, actors, writers, athletes.
Yeah. If Minna and Ada didn't know you personally, you had to have a letter of referral. So they were very strict about that. But the club was known throughout the world. It's why Prince Henry wanted to come there. You know, when he arrived in New York and this bored press corps greeted him and said, Prince, what would you like to see during your time in America? Do you want to see the Grand Canyon, the Statue of Liberty? And the prince says, no, I want to see the Early Club of Chicago. So it was sort of this worldwide symbol and a worldwide attraction. And the Everly sisters made sure that everyone knew that their place was the place to go if you were going to be visiting Chicago.
How did people in Europe know about the Everly Club?
Well, one of the reasons, I think, is because, if we want to talk about the reformers for a second, I think it's because mm-hmm. the reform movement began in Europe and then came over to America. So, they had close contact. Many European reformers and American reformers kept in constant touch with each other and updated each other on red light districts. And so, of course, the Everly Club was a place that was spoken about quite a bit, even though they really had nothing to do with the white slave trade. And their whole idea was, if we elevate the business, if we remove the stain from the stigmatized profession, then there wouldn't be any need for reform. Everybody would just be, it would be run respectably and everyone would be happy.
Were there attempts at this point in history to legalize prostitution, to regulate it?
Well, there are, prostitution was technically illegal. The only instance I know where it was attempted to be legalized was earlier in St. Louis, and it was like a failed attempt there for 4 years, a short-lived attempt. And it was a reform movement that crushed it. But the politicians in Chicago and elsewhere in America with red light districts, their idea was to segregate it. And their thinking was that if we keep this sort of, keep all the red light districts and all the brothels in one area, that it would be less likely to infiltrate in their respectable neighborhoods. And so that was their thinking, and respectable society women would be safe from rape if all the men who would incline to do something like that would just went to the red light district instead.
Mm. And because this was an illegal activity, what kind of graft was required? What kind of, money under the table was being passed back and forth?
Oh, an enormous amount of graft. And Bathhouse John and Hinky Dink, Bathhouse John Coughlin and Hinky Dink Kenna were at the head of this. And they collected, they set standard prices for every, little small houses, for people who kept craps and poker tables, for people who served liquor after hours, to medium-sized brothels, to a place like the Everly Club, which paid about $800 or so a month. All told, by 1910, over the course of a decade, the levy collectively paid about $15 million in graft, which is just, more than $300 million today. It's an insane amount.
Mm. I mentioned in my introduction, and we've talked a little bit about this, the care with which Ada took interviewing and selecting young women for the club. Who were the girls she was likely to select?
Well, she made sure that none of them, I think her criteria was, you must look good in the evening gown, you must have a pretty face and pretty figure, you must not drink to excess, you must not do drugs. They preferred girls who had a little bit of experience in a nice brothel, because the fresh-faced girls who were just off the train had a tendency to run off and get married right away, and the turnover was greater with those sorts of girls. But they were very strict about making sure the girls took care of themselves.
Were they allowed to have sweethearts?
Yeah, there was something called Beau Night. Every Sunday night, any girl at the Everly Club who had a boyfriend on the outside, he was permitted to come to the club and bring her flowers and hold her hand and speak to her in the parlors, and sort of they got a chance to act like they were on a date.
Did the sisters have some say over who the sweethearts could be?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think they tried to stay out of the girls' business as much as possible. As long as they were obeying the club rules, they allowed for some discretion. But of course, if the girls had men who were sort of disrespecting the club rules, they would sort of surely take care of that.
Yeah. The club was in operation from 1900 to 1911. Over that period of time, how many young women worked in the club as prostitutes?
600. Ada Wow. Minna estimated that about 600 people, 600 women passed through the club doors. Excuse me. And a lot of them, became more famous than others. There was a woman named Diamond Bertha who met a sort of tragic end. She was found in an alleyway with her jewels cut off, her hands cut off, and her jewels gone. There was another courtesan named Nellie who committed suicide. So, you know, I found that interesting, too. In the book, I write about all these fun anecdotes and all
yeah.
these visitors. But yet, there's a real undercurrent of tragedy because women entered this business not always for the happiest reasons. Their husbands deserted them, and they had children to support, or their parents died, and they had siblings, or some of them were considered promiscuous and kicked out of the home and figured, well, we might as well make money at it. So there were some very difficult circumstances these girls came from, and it wasn't all, you know, there definitely is a dark undercurrent through the book, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because this is really very, very serious issues here at work. Did the girls, and I'm using the term girls, the young women, did they live in the house? Where did they live?
Oh, they each had their own boudoir.
Yeah.
Once they were accepted as an Everly Club butterfly, as Minna called them, they were encouraged to think of it as home.
Yeah. Oh. I wonder if Hugh Hefner was aware of the history of the Everly Club.
I don't know. I got a little mention in Playboy in July, though, so that made me happy. I hope, and I'm sure we sent him a book, but I haven't heard anything from him personally. But, you know, I guess he's a big Chicago guy, and he probably knows his Chicago history.
Yeah, because I kind of, you know, think in terms of the creation of the bunny, he's a pretty savvy. He was a very savvy. He still is a savvy businessman.
And, oh, absolutely.
And, he probably would be very comfortable talking with the Everly sisters.
I'm sure. And yeah. I'm sure they would have given him the Prince Henry treatment, too. They would have made Hugh very happy.
Yeah. I'd like to be there for that
I know,
meeting.
Me too.
Yeah. Well, back to the stories of the dark side of prostitution, you know, there were women who found themselves even in worse straits than the women of the Everly Club. And there were these stories of young women being lured to the city, drugged, and sold to madams. When did these stories begin to appear in print? When did they take off? Was there any one story that lit the fire?
Yeah, there was. In 1907, a girl named Mona Marshall, the story goes, the most quoted story goes, that she tossed a note out of a brothel window that said, "Help me, I am a white slave," and a passerby picked it up and brought it to the police. The police happened to call a lawyer by the name of Clifford Rowe, who was a state's attorney at the time, and a very ambitious, manipulative, cunning man who saw an opportunity to make a political career for himself fighting white slavery, the so-called white slave trade. There was a great Tribune article that sort of summed up Clifford Rowe better than anything I could say. It said, "On the day of Mr. Rowe's birth, he gave a speech on the wrongs of infants and has been speaking on the rights or wrongs of someone or another ever since." And he did that. He really put himself out there. He wanted to be known as the William Lloyd Garrison of the white slavery movement. And he was quite successful at making a national name for himself.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Just something that occurred to me. What happened when they were no longer useful when they got older? And did they go out and become sales clerks or what?
Well, in the Everly Club, you know, a lot of them married or just they made enough money to go on and live their own lives once they didn't want to work anymore. In the lesser brothels, you know, it was the physical decline, you know, meant that you were not a valuable commodity anymore. you were kicked out. A lot of girls ended up in the hop houses as drug addicts. A lot of them ended up as streetwalkers. They weren't able to get a job in a house anymore. They had to sort of fend for themselves. So, you know, there was that risk as you aged. Your ability to make a living for yourself certainly declined.
Yeah, and how about health care? I mean, it's not a pretty picture.
No, it's not.
Romantic.
It's not.
And, you know, it's so exploitive and happens now, too. There are children who are just pressed into this, too, in many countries.
Yeah, it's well, healthcare for the Everlys. They were probably the only house that actually kept a respected and honest doctor on staff who regularly examined the girls and even advised them on how to work their business so that they would be have the least risk for disease. But you know, it wasn't a safe venture for anybody. Syphilis was rampant. Girls, if they got pregnant, you know, they had all these sort of home remedies to try to fix these conditions. But girls who got pregnant, there were actually baby farms run by former madams who would take care of prostitutes' children.
Yeah, tell us more about that. That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
You're
very welcome. Thanks for the call. Baby farms.
Yeah, it was a brief mention. They had baby farms for prostitutes' children, you know, girls. A lot of harlots used a sort of douche concoction to try to prevent pregnancy, and they would even do concoct some homemade morphine medicines to it wouldn't cure syphilis, but it would alleviate symptoms. So,
yeah, let's take another call. Listener in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you'd come across anything, any connection between Leonard Keeley's Gold Cure for alcoholism in Dwight, Illinois, and either the women or the clients of the Everly Club?
No, alcoholism was a hazard of the profession, but I really focused on the Everly Club, and if the girls were drinking to excess there, they didn't stay around very long. So no, I didn't venture too far into the cure for alcoholism.
Well, thank the listener for her call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Karen Abbott. She's the author of Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question, a comment, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. So it was the stories of white slavery that fired up the imagination of Americans and reformers. Who became involved in the efforts to clean up the city of Chicago in particular and close down its brothels?
Well, it was basically, I focused on two reformers in the book. The one is the minister Ernest Bell, who began a midnight mission, he called it, in 1904. And the Midnight Mission's main goal was to preach outside the Everly Club every night. And they did. They tried to dissuade men from entering there. And he gathered steam and gathered force. And he joined forces with Clifford Rowe eventually, the state's attorney I mentioned. And they were really the two main players in Chicago who really got the rest of the country involved. There was also something called the National Purity Congress at the time, which struck me as it's just something that you could almost see happening today. It was sort of a right-wing religious group that came in and was trying to legislate this, legislate morality, and really fight the prostitution red light districts across the country. And they would go to each city and hold purity congresses and talk about all the ways they could purify America's soul and save America's girls from this certain ruin.
Mm. Let's take another call. Listener in Arcola on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. Enjoy your show. I work with a group in Springfield called Pora, and they work to help women that are on the street to get off. But your show is interesting. I think we need to learn lessons from history, but there's a lot of talk about the past and, you know, how it happens in other countries. But there's a lot of women that come internationally to this country that are in that, you know, sex slave trade. And I was wondering if you had any comments on that.
You know, I definitely, I haven't read too much about the sex slave trade of today. I spent, you know, years sifting through the white slavery panic of the turn of the century. And, you know, I think like today, though, there's questions about exactly how much it's going on. You know, there's no question it occurred here and there, but at the turn of the century, at least, it's certain that the statistics were exaggerated. You know, the reformers were claiming that 60,000 American girls died every year. And are you willing to sacrifice your daughter for this terrible business? But under closer scrutiny, it appears that a lot of the instances where white slavery was suspected, the girl actually was a willing prostitute, or did it for her own accord.
Well, yeah, I understand that. I know there's all kinds of statistics that can be exaggerated today, but the numbers are, I don't have them at my fingertips, they are staggering. There's a lot of women that are brought over and they, you know, because their families owe money and their families back in China or wherever,
right,
threatened with death, or Mexico or any number of European countries as well.
Right.
And so I do think it's a problem. I don't know if you can address
it. Yeah, that's something it shares with the turn of the century, too. It was, you know, the reformers also talked about immigrant girls arriving at the dock and being abducted and drugged and sold into brothels. So, of course, there's always a danger for a newcomer to this country who's destitute and has no family and doesn't speak the language.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Near the end of the book, you talk about some of the outcomes of this, what you call, long, strange moral panic. One was a positive result. You say the Illinois legislature in 1913 created a Senate Vice Committee to investigate the link between prostitution and wages. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it was true. There were a few lasting ramifications from the white slavery panic. One was the FBI, if I could just talk about that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Mann Act was passed in 1910, which forbade the transportation of women over state lines for quote-unquote immoral purposes. And, of course, a lot of people got in trouble because immoral purposes wasn't clearly defined. You know, Jack Johnson, the boxer, and Frank Lloyd Wright were two victims of the Mann Act. And the FBI was really beefed up to enforce the Mann Act. Before the Mann Act, the FBI was just sort of a low-level government bureaucracy that handled minor crimes. And after the Mann Act was passed, it was staffed and, you know, with agents in every city and an enormous operating budget. So that really grew the FBI. And as you said, Celeste, the other result was this panel in which people examined the idea that perhaps women were entering prostitution because their wages as a clerk were so low. You know, who can live on $6 a week? And people who, you know, women who had worked as prostitutes wrote letters into the commission saying, you know, what else was I going to do? I had a young daughter. I'm getting paid $6 a week. At nighttime, I tried to sew to supplement my income. And also, when I worked as a secretary, they expected me to look a certain way, and I had to buy clothing at Marshall Fields, and who can afford to do that? I couldn't buy clothing for my daughter for school. I mean, so you know, that was a positive result.
Yeah. Well, the house closed the club closed in 1911, and Minna and Ada lived a number of years past that. Minna died in 1948, Ada in 1960. We have to wrap up here, but tell us just a little bit about their lives after the Everly Club.
Oh, I love what they did afterward. They sort of reclaimed their mysterious past. They wanted everyone to think that the Everly sisters were dead. So they move to a brownstone on the Upper West Side of New York, and they take the surname Lester. And it's great because they bring with them all of these artifacts from the club. They bring the gold piano. They bring their risque nude oil paintings. They bring their, you know, their nude statues. And they would invite their neighbors over, these sort of blue-haired old ladies who would come over and read poetry with them. And they called themselves the Lester Poetry Circle. And little servants would mill about with little cakes and tea. And all of their friends would say, Minna and Ada, you know, what is this painting on the wall? What is this naughty statue here? And and the sisters would say, oh, please don't mind that. Our grandfather struck gold in 1849, and he's the one who passed on these artifacts to us, and they're family heirlooms, and we just can't bear to part with them. Please don't take offense.
Yeah.
So they sort of reinvented themselves again and lived quiet lives with each other. And you know, to me, the book is really a love story between these two women, ultimately.
Yeah. There, we've got to leave it. We're out of time. Karen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Karen Abbott has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of Sin in the Second City, Madams, Ministers, Playboys, and the Battle for America's Soul. The book is published by Random House. The website, www.sininthesecondcity.com.